This is an interview with Andrew Pastrick for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program by Stephen Evanson at his home on March 4th at 3:30 p.m. Mr. Pastrick, what do you remember about your parents and your family? Do you remember what type of work he did, or your father, or did your mother work part-time? Or?
My parents were of Slovak descent. And my dad died in 1926 of peritonitis. At that time, I was five and a half years old. Due to economic conditions, my mother did have to go to work.
Where did she work?
And she worked for United States Steel as a inspector in the assorting department up until 1937 or 38 when the plants closed.
Do you remember what, growing up around that time, it was near the Depression, do you remember, did you have gardens, did you eat regularly, or,
Oh yes, at that time, in the neighborhood, almost everybody had, either chickens or, a cow, gardens, almost every yard had a had a garden. This is gardens, grapevines, fruit trees, and everybody, of course, at that time did a lot of canning to preserve food for the winter.
Where did you actually grow up? Was it in Struthers?
No, I was born in Newcastle and lived there till going into the service. And after the service, I moved to Struthers in 1947.
Well, can you tell us something about your childhood, maybe particular activities you got involved in, or sports, social gatherings, or anything like that?
On the earliest childhood, I can recall, again, as I say, when Dad died, we were just more or less close to home. Sports were all neighborhood empty lots where you could play ball using makeshift toys.
Really?
I said that you didn't have a baseball, you had a ball bat, you used a stick and a bunch of old rag bound together to play with a baseball, or you made a football the same way if you couldn't find one. You put bikes together from parts you found in the trash somewhere to help a bike. And I said, outside of going to Catholic school, which was almost across the street from us, about three, four houses down, was St. Michael's. St. Michael's School and Church.
Is it still there?
It's still there, to the best of my knowledge. I know the church is still there. I don't know if they're still keeping the school, which I presume they are.
Was there... Do you remember actually what school was like? Maybe perhaps any particular teacher, maybe, or anything like that? Grade school or high school?
No, we had nuns for teachers up to the sixth grade, is all the school was. After the sixth grade, we went to public school, Ben Franklin Junior High. And that was a 3-year school, and you got to be a sophomore. They only had 3 years of high school then, which you have four now, I believe.
Yeah.
And they only had 3 years of high school then.
I see. Well, being in school, what was your favorite subject? Was it any kind of, woodshop or any kind of, trade or anything?
No, mostly in school, in high school. I would say probably that biology and salesmanship were the two most interesting courses.
Right.
Besides, I liked mathematics, since I did do mathematics, although I didn't get to the finer parts of math like trig and the others, but
you did
we did have it. Big pardon?
Did you graduate from high school?
And I graduated from Newcastle High School, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I did work or go to school till 38. And again, due to economic conditions, when all the mills closed in Newcastle, I got a job through my track coach, Bill Klee, who was also my home study teacher. And he got me a job at Haney Furniture as more or less a stock boy. But we went out and set up displays, and after the salesman got through showing people furniture,
yeah,
that tear everything around, we'd go back, put it all together. And new models we would take and put out, and stuff was sold, they'd take it off the floor, and we'd have to replace it. Yeah. So I worked at Haney Furniture Company, and then when the mills closed, like I say, I had the choice of keeping a job and dropping out of school or quitting my job. Well, at that time, jobs weren't easy to find, so I stayed on a job. And unfortunately, by Thanksgiving, when the rest of the mill shut down, and I got laid off. 1938.
Was there? It wasn't strikes. It was just.
It was. Closed. It was just like we had here with Sheet and Tube and these other plants. The mills just shut down, and everybody was out of work. So naturally, I was laid off and decided to go back to school since there was no work available. I went back to school and graduated in January of 39. And after graduation, even, there was nothing to do, so I stayed on to postgraduate work till the summer of 39.
This is a question I wanted to ask. What particular styles were prominent then? Like, what trends, like fancy cars or, you know?
Well, the cars, the cars at that time, well, that was still before Bobby Sox days. Dress was more or less the conservative type of dress. We wore blue jeans then after we took off our good clothes. Today, everybody wears blue jeans being the style. But cars were then, I would say they were flashy in a type, especially in the convertible types.
Do you remember your first car?
Yes, I remember the first car. 1937 Ford.
My dad's was a 36, isn't it?
37 Ford.
Gee.
It was some car. They called them puddle jumpers.
It was
a Ford 6 then at the time, a six-cylinder car. And
what did you pay for it?
I think $150.
Wow. Before entering the service, can you, besides the Haney Furniture, what other places were you employed at?
Well, after I went back to school, a friend of mine got me a job in a restaurant. I wouldn't even know the name of it now. It was George's Restaurant. It was more or less a hot dog and hamburger shop at that time, although he did serve some meals. He had special customers that come in.
And you were a cook?
And that's what we'd do. The theater was next door, and after everybody would come out of the theater, they'd all come in and eat hot dogs, which we sold then three for a dime.
Wow.
And I worked for $1.50 a week. And that was 6 days a week.
After that, did you go into any type of millwork or...
After that, I did get a job with Shenango Pen Mold in Neville Island, and I lived in Coriopolis approximately, stayed there, worked there about a year, till I come back and got a job with Frank C. Dowd's machine shop company here in Newcastle at that time.
How many years did you work there?
And I worked at Frank C. Dowd's. I guess about 2 years before I went in the service.
Do you remember your boss, sir?
Yes, my boss and the president and boss was Kenneth C. Bowman. And I worked with Nick Cassalandra, who just died last month.
Mm-hmm.
was a great fella.
Do you recall any type of training or any for that profession, or was there some kind of apprenticeship?
No, it wasn't an apprenticeship. Mostly, you started out by having some other fella showing you or teaching you.
Mm-hmm.
And after they decided you were
qualified
enough to operate the machinery and equipment, why, you just went ahead and went on your own.
Did you, speaking of on your own, were you on your own? Did you still live at home, or?
No, I was living at home.
Because a lot of people today want to move out and, yeah, get on their own. But did you ever, at the time now, you dropped out of school because you felt the work was more important then, at the time? But
at that time, work was most important. Like I say, due to economic conditions.
Was it even your family?
There was nobody. No, my brother, I had a brother 4 years older than me, and he got a job in a bakery. My sister stayed at home until, I don't recall what year, but she got a job finally.
In other words, everything was a group effort just to eat.
Right, it was a job just to try it. If you could find a job, you were lucky, but if you got a job, at least you made enough to keep a home going.
That's true. Around that time, right prior to the 40s, you know, was the atmosphere like among your friends and stuff, war was starting to brew up, we knew that the Americans might be in it. This was before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Did you have that feeling that the U.S. might be, you know, building up? And, you know, they were, from what I understand, making a lot of military goods for other countries and stuff.
At that time, I think the general feeling was that the United States was invincible. Mm-hmm. Even though the war did break out,
mm-hmm.
Most of the people that you talked to felt that nobody hardly dare attack the United States.
Boy. But
we were starting then to get mechanized and produce a lot of durable goods, plus,
mm-hmm.
Like you say, munitions, and we were getting involved into the war due to England. I would think mostly we were going to help our allies more than we were doing it for ourselves up until Pearl Harbor, of course.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, lost my train of thought here. About the service, were you drafted, or would you like to, were you inspired to go?
No, at my first, not job, but the job I was on at the time the war broke out was at Dad Machine Company, which was manufacturing then bomb parts for the government, both for the U.S. Navy and the Army.
Mm-hmm. But at that time...
And as the draft was going on, people who were working on vital defense programs were deferred. I did get called up, and the company got me a deferment.
What were your feelings?
At that time,
happy.
Whenever most of my friends were going into the service, there were three of us that palled around together. And we all decided, since there was no work, we were going to join the services. Each one of us wanted a different branch of the service.
Mm-hmm.
So none of us agreed. However, whenever the one friend went into the Navy, who wanted to go into the Marines, the other one wanted to be in the Navy, he went into the Army. And the third one, he did go into the Navy because he wanted the Navy. He ended up in the Submarine Corps. I kept seeing all my friends go. And, of course, neighbors and other friends. And it was a feeling like being left alone. My brother, older brother had gone, my brother-in-law had gone, even my younger brother enlisted and left for the service. Since I was the only one at home, they wanted me to stay, or I could have probably got a hardship deferment, or at that time, they were allowed one male member of the family as a sole survivor in case anybody in the family got killed. So there would be one male survivor in the family. But it, like I say, at the time when everybody was going and my deferment came through, I stayed another 3 months, at which time I told them that if my deferment ends, or when it ends, that I had thoughts of entering the service, not to request a second deferment.
I understand. You know, when you were talking about that, you were working at that
machine
plant. Did the orders start to increase? You know, could you tell that, well, hey, you know, the United States might be building themselves up, and even at that period of time?
Well,
Or did you pay it no mind, actually?
No, actually, that work came about, really, at Pearl Harbor. I said, after we got into the war, then they really switched. The company originally made steam ejector valves. As a matter of fact, for Youngstown Sheet and Tube, it was just a small machine company. But then when the war broke out, they switched to defense materials. They got government contracts and started to manufacture then PT boat stabilizers for the Navy, and we made for, I think it was the 500-pound bomb, detonators.
300%.
So the switch came about due to the war. There was no buildup in a plant.
Oh,
of course, a lot of plants started during the war because the government subsidized them to produce war material. But ordinarily, the company would have probably still been making steam ejector valves had there not been a war. I don't think that they had planned any buildup on it. But the government at that time did give subsidies or loans to companies who would manufacture parts for the government.
What branch of service did you go into originally?
I went into the infantry.
Is that what you desired, or?
No, it was no desire. Of course, after you get inducted into the Army, I don't know how they picked certain men to go to certain outfits. I guess it was where they were needed, plus evidently tests that they gave you. And I had applied for the Quartermaster Corps due to the fact that I'd worked in a machine shop and was familiar with mechanical tools and stuff. I had applied for a Quartermaster Corps. I did go to a school at Camp Croft for 12 weeks, I think it was, 12 or 16 weeks. It was an armor artificer school, which was the repair and maintenance of weapons.
Okay.
However, evidently there were no openings at that time, and the war escalating in Europe, they just...
Anybody could carry a gun.
Put us into the infantry. Where I ended up in.
What year was this? Do you remember the day?
You got
inducted?
I was inducted into the... Armed Services on March 29th, 1944. And after basic training at Camp Croft...
Is that Camp Croft?
Okay. In South Carolina, yeah. I was transferred to Camp McCoy in Wisconsin in October the 1st of 44. That was the 76th Division, which was made up mostly, I think, of Maryland National Guardsmen.
Okay. But you, at the time, you didn't think of the military as a, did you want it as a career, maybe, or you thinking of just getting your time done?
Well, providing, unemployment being what it was, most of the fellas at that time, which were in the 18 to 21 year age group, there was no work, and there were a lot of volunteers that enlisted, and they were just regular Army or regular Navy, whatever guys just went and signed up because there was no work, like a lot of the young kids are doing today. They can't find a job, so they just enlist in the services. I did, yes, I did think of the Army as a career, and I had almost hoped to stay into the service.
Do you remember who your boot camp instructor was? When you were, was it Fort Croft?
Camp Croft.
Camp Croft. Do you remember his name?
Yeah, I remember his name. It was Sergeant Bamey and Sergeant Carlucci.
Nice guys.
which we got to be real good friends. Yeah, I was in his company, and a couple months later, they moved us to another company. This was, of course, still good weather in April, May, June, and we played a lot of softball. I happened to manage a team opposing Sergeant Carlucci, and we got to be pretty good friends in rivalry.
I see.
And we have a pretty good friendship. As a matter of fact, he come close to, he did try to get me to stay on as an instructor at the basic camp.
Did you increase in rank?
Well, at that time, no. Nobody, well, unless you would have been assigned to the camp, you probably could have. But in training, nobody got promoted during the basic training.
Like you were saying before, you did receive some kind of training while in the service or you wanted to, that was it, I'm sorry. You wanted like to get into the machine.
Yeah, there was training. I said the only other opportunity was you could have, which some fellows did, volunteer for either parachute corps or officer candidate school.
Mm-hmm.
And you could apply, but like I say, if there was no need or if the quotas were filled, you stayed in the infantry.
How did your family feel? I mean, about you and finally entering the service, from what you tell me that your brother had gone, your...
Well, that was heartbreaking. My mother took it real hard. There was nobody left at home. My sister was pregnant and had lost their baby. My brother-in-law at that time, I forget where he was, whether he was in Florida, Texas, already overseas. I believe he was already overseas. And there was nobody at home to manage the house, or take care of things around home that had to be done.
And was she still working?
No. No, of course, like I say, when the mills closed, she was out of a job, and which was before Social Security ever come in to give any kind of compensation or any kind of help. And it hurt, I know, her more so, especially whenever she saw other fellows at home, which didn't go into the service.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, either due to the fact that they were physically disqualified or through deferments or whatever reasons did not enter the military. And living in a, which was mostly an ethnic neighborhood, everybody knew everybody. And if you'd see all the people as it did, didn't go, it hurt her. I think it hurt her more than anybody else.
Before the war, actually, I asked this question to other interviewees, and what was, you know, your feeling like about taking another man's life? Maybe, how did you feel before the war, and then in camp, did it, they inflicted upon you where you had to come when it came down to it, you know, it was your life or his, or, you know?
Originally, it didn't seem to bother me. I would think that whenever you went to war, like it's in the movies, I says you see mm-hmm. pictures of it, but it doesn't strike you until you have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know that whenever we went overseas, we had two or three fellas that refused to go into combat because they didn't want to shoot or kill anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, whenever it gets down to the point where it's either your life or his, you're going to pull the trigger.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, okay, after boot camp, what was your next destination? What was it?
Well, after we left Camp Croft, we were sent to the 76th Division, which was stationed at Camp McCoy, to fill their complement. And the division was to be a reserve division.
Mm-hmm.
And primarily, we didn't know where we were going due to the fact that one day they'd issue us summer clothing, 2-3 weeks later they'd issue us winter clothing. They kept you on a run, guessing to where you were going to go, whether it was a European theater or the Pacific theater.
Mm-hmm.
And
you'd go
training 1 week, and they'd put you through all kind of winter maneuvers, and following week you'd come back to camp, and then you'd go through summer drills. We actually didn't know, because after we finally got put on the alert, Camp McCoy, and we got sent aboard a troop train, which we didn't know where we were going, although we did travel east and ended up at Camp Miles Standish up in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did know that we were heading for the European Theater.
I see. What was the thoughts maybe going through your mind then? Were you regretting, or?
Well, at that time, we knew that that was going to be.
Were you finally satisfied to say, hey, all this training's finally, you know?
Well, no, not really, because everybody still, I think most of the guys really still felt that they wanted to stay stateside.
Mm-hmm.
And the division, like I say, was hastily put together. And as the war was escalating, we were getting knocked about. The United States and the Allies were getting sort of pushed around in Europe and in the Pacific. That although you knew it was inevitable that we were going to go, there was still hopes of staying stateside.
Right.
Nobody seemed to want to be that eager to jump into it right then.
In other words, everybody's feelings were that way, you know. But there was, yeah. Okay. I understand that. After that, after you were in Massachusetts, where did you go from there?
The point of debarkation was Boston. We left there Thanksgiving Day, and that's one day I won't forget. We ate Thanksgiving dinner three times that day. Once in camp, and then at supper time, one of the USO or some other outfit came and served us turkey dinners, and then we got aboard ship, and we ate turkey again.
On the ship?
On the ship.
Do you remember the name of the ship that took you over?
Yes, I went across on a Marine Raven, USS Marine Raven, which was an oil tanker originally converted to a troop transport. And a ride you'll never forget, because we just were like a cork bobbing in a water due to the ship not being having a regular ballast on it. Or
mm-hmm. It wasn't equipped.
It wasn't what you'd call a smooth ride.
And where did you arrive at after?
We arrived at Southampton in England.
Mm. Okay. Who was your leader, commander then? I mean, were you under certain group?
Our commander?
Yeah.
You mean the general? Or the...
Yeah, who was issuing, you know, who was overlooking your division? I mean,
Schmidt was... if I could have the...
Take your time.
Probably doesn't have it. This is General Mays.
Mm-hmm.
you recall the leader of your
circuit? Yeah, Captain Fetzer was a leader of our company.
Mm-hmm.
And my lieutenant of was a fellow from Akron named Holbertson. Our platoon sergeant was Pete Healthdaler from around New York. He was our platoon sergeant.
You know, after arriving in Southampton, did you proceed to go straight into action, or did you?
We stayed at Southampton approximately, 3 weeks. And evidently, they were waiting to see what division we would replace. But the Battle of the Bulge in December sort of changed the tactics.
I see. There was
the Battle of the Bulge was in December of 44, and
there was some. Now, from what I understand, the Bulge actually they were coming in from the south of France, and also there was like two strikes actually. They were because, from what I understand, I might be wrong.
No, they did. They pinched the Americans there, and. Bastogne, Malmedy were two of the most horrors of the war for massacring soldiers, civilians, people were just shot and killed.
Did you witness this? Or?
And no, I wasn't in it. My brother was in the 26th Infantry Division in the field artillery. They were in it, and after the Battle of the Bulge, they took our outfit, and that what sent us to Europe.
I see. You know, arriving in Europe, tell us about the type of people that you encountered, the citizens mostly. I mean, were they peasant? I mean,
well, from the time we arrived, I was trying to think, was it Le Havre that we landed in France? We were sort of kept on a move. Our contact with the people was very little, except whenever we would be moved by truck, we would stay at farms or farmhouses, and then the people there that did still live there. Some places they stayed, and other places we stayed, like old monasteries, which were abandoned. You bivouacked there.
What was the
name of this town? Picked up and moved. So I really went through Paris three times. I never got to see Paris. So as we moved, we were on a troop train. We weren't allowed to get off. We weren't allowed to move.
Oh,
you got out and you stretched, and you had to stay right in the immediate vicinity.
Mm-hmm.
So we really didn't have too much contact with the people, the natives. The only other people we had contact with really were other soldiers or other government people from the United States.
Now you say, the name of the town, do you recall, that you landed in after leaving Southampton, that was?
At Le Havre.
Le Havre, okay. Okay. After, you know, arriving, you know, after you arriving in Le Havre. Can you probably, you know, take your time and tell us some of the experiences you encountered while over there, or if there was actual combat, did you see, you know, actual combat?
No, we didn't see or get involved with any actual combat until we got, I would say approximately 10-15 miles of the front lines. At that time we were in Luxembourg, and our first real engagement with the enemy was crossing the Saar River at Echternach. At that time, the Allies started a counteroffensive on the Siegfried Line mm-hmm. in Germany. And shells popping. Oh, yeah, we did. Before we did get down into Echternach, we were marching into the town, and the enemy did start shelling us. At that time, General Cota, the 28th Infantry Division, the Keystone Division, came up to sort of give us a pep talk going into battle. And as we got shelled, he was among the ones that dove for a foxhole the same as we had to jump. That was the first taste, really, I think, of enemy action, until we had crossed the Saar River in Echternach.
I understand. Was there any, do you recall any kind of...
No, the incident, crossing the river was one. The river was swollen. We were all put into boats. I forget, there were 12 or 16 men in a boat. Everybody got a paddle, and everybody was paddling a different way. That a lot of the boats
there
capsized.
There was no types of bridges?
And, no, the bridges were knocked out. We had to cross by boat.
Mm-hmm.
So we used the boats to cross the river.
I understand. From what I, they, at that period of time, Germany was trying to, I understand, do anything they can to isolate.
To prevent a counterattack then, yes.
Mm-hmm. I see. But, now, what year, this was about 1945, did you say? You were over there in your scene?
Right, yeah. We left, I think it was about 2 days after Christmas that we left Southampton, and it was in January of 45 that we did get into the combat area.
Now, leading up during the war, can you possibly tell us how, you know, what kind of hazards you had, you know, what actually did you have to look out for while marching and stuff? You know, was there
as you advanced on foot, you were told to be careful, to watch for landmines and booby traps, which were set mm-hmm. by the enemy, and we used to have if you traveled. Which very seldom we traveled by truck.
They would
have an advance group go through to check the roads and make sure they were clear of mines.
Mm-hmm.
But most of our advancing was on foot.
I see.
Naturally, the infantry is a foot soldier. And
mm-hmm. How many people would be in a group, let's say, while you were over there? How many, do you recall?
Oh, in a group. Well, yeah. Your squads were 12 men. You had about 60 men, 50 to 60 in a platoon. The company ran about 120, 150 men.
Okay. So, in other words, you were never separated from your platoon or your company. You were always, you know, you never got...
Oh, yeah. The smallest you would be... would ordinarily be a squad, unless you went on reconnaissance, which at that time I was a first scout, and we had two scouts leading the rest of the squad or platoon.
Mm-hmm. When was your first encounter with the enemy? I mean, you say at that river?
Well,
the
first encounter, we didn't see the enemy when we crossed the river, outside of them shelling us and our bombs going there.
Mm-hmm.
But after we had crossed Echternach and were on our way to Eschweiler,
mm-hmm.
We were going up the road, and my first encounter with the enemy was Three men jumped out in the road, German soldiers, among them was a lieutenant, which were surrendering, trying to surrender. And the lieutenant had given me his Luger.
Oh, I see.
And the other two were evidently enlisted men. Of course, as we were advancing, they were taken captives and just taken back to the rear area for questioning.
Mm-hmm. I see. But you never had experienced any type of, like I said before, one-on-one combat where your life was in danger? Or?
Oh, yes. At night, we were on, you had to have an outpost. Mm-hmm. And at night, we'd be out in the outpost on top of a hill. And we would sit there and just keep watching across the valley to see where the Germans were. And they'd be shooting back their 88 millimeter, the screaming memes. And
If
I'd have known, I should have got some of these notes out. I know, but I didn't. I don't have. I have to look to see what the hell I did have. You know, I had them somewhere. See, here's some of the Lieutenant Rainey. Here's some of the trips. Here's the way the division went.
Yeah. If you don't mind, I'd like to get a nice copy of that.
Yeah.
That's interesting, you know, because a lot of people, you know, didn't have scrapbooks then and never really considered the thought.
I don't know from what page that is. This is something telling about crossing in boats. This is it. Crossing the Sire River, 6 miles to the town of Echternach, where we had to cross the swift, long river, and the icy crust on the roads didn't make it easier. Because it was our first combat, we weren't sure just what, how much ammo to carry. Artillery shells had been whistling overhead spasmodically for 2 weeks. We were talking, we were talking about being at the outpost, mm-hmm. And one of the most tragic things was our artillery mm-hmm. observers had been up there, and they said not to worry, that they'll never hit the top of the hill. All these 88s were hitting the side of the cliff. One day, we were just about being relieved when Lieutenant Bell happened to come up. And whether the Germans moved up their guns or what, there were three shells that just blew right around us, and one of them hit the shrapnel, hit Lieutenant Bell, and cut his jugular vein. And myself and two others carried him back to our post, and Lieutenant Bell died. It was my first death experience mm-hmm. with either the enemy or our own, seeing anybody killed in the war.
Mm-hmm. At that point, did you feel that if I see the next German, I'm going to...
That's when it made you sort of shaky. And you knew then that you were actually in combat with the enemy.
What I want to lead up to is... from what I understand, you had an accident during the service. Is that correct? Or?
Yes. After we had dug in, we went to replace the 5th Infantry Division. And after we had dug in, we were to be relieved. Oh, I think in 2 days. So on our trip back to the rest area, mm-hmm. we were told that we had to take another objective. It was approximately 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, just before dusk. And we started out.
Do you remember what day it was?
Yes, I do remember the day. The day I'll never forget. It was February 14th, 1945, St. Valentine's Day. And we had crossed the road, and our lieutenant decided to take us through the field around the wooded area, which was presumed to be the enemy was had a few outposts there, because we were getting mostly rifle fire, sniper fire, and they thought there were some snipers in that wooded area, so we were to surround the area. The lieutenant decided to take us through the field. We started to cross the field and noticed a sign reading Mehmet, which in German meant minefield. After a few probes, the lieutenant thought that there were no mines there, and we started to go on. As we got in further, the barbed wire was strung across the field, and every man was told to make sure that as he stepped over the wire, not to trip the wire. And the lieutenant started to backtrack, and as he got toward me, he told me, "Pastrick, make sure where you step." He says, "One false move and you're a dead," and as he was to say duck, a landmine exploded. And the mine got the sergeant behind me, who was leading the second platoon. At that time I was the assistant squad leader, so I had all the rest of the men out of the field ahead of me, and the second squad was behind me, and the lieutenant, myself, and the sergeant all got hit at the same time.
Okay. Were they severely injured, or
the sergeant had died?
Do you remember his name? Well, maybe it'll come back to you.
It will that be, because but he was another big kid.
The lieutenant was...
Lieutenant had received some shrapnel wound, but only sustained minor injuries.
And this was...
My foot. I got hit around the foot, the ankle. My boot was about blowed off of my foot. And due to the fact that they realized we were in a minefield, there was nobody anxious to come in to get us. By that time, it had gotten dark, and everybody was scared to go in, to come into the minefield. So we sat there until our medic had come up. And the sergeant that got hit was... It was Jones, but I'm trying to think of his first name. That Jonesy had got hit, and he was going to try to get him out of there. Our medic was Greg Kirchner. We all called him Doc. He was from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Doc had come in, and Doc and I were pretty close. We had gone to church in England, and he was quite religious. He sang in a choir, got me to go with him to sing in a choir. So when we got into combat, Doc sort of looked after me, I would say. He was a little longer in the service than I was, and I guess he had had a little bit of experience, although it was his first combat too. But Doc had volunteered to come into the minefield and help get me out. And
were you completely, your mind?
I was mostly semi-conscious. I didn't recall exactly how long I had laid in the minefield, but I do know when they got me out, it was getting daylight. It was starting to get daylight. And we sat at the edge of the road and had to wait for ambulances to come up, take us to a hospital, which was a field hospital, which they set up at the front lines.
Do you remember what it was like being in that field hospital?
Hospital I went to was more or less like a camp, mm-hmm. and it was a hospital where they had given you emergency treatment. From there, they took us by ambulance to the 35th Field Evac, and that hospital was in an old German bunker. Mm-hmm. It was Terminal Tower in Cleveland. The concourse, there were about 18, 20 steps. You'd walk down one flight, then you'd have 18, 20 more steps. And I said it was a gigantic tunnel underground. It almost resembled a city, that there were so many rooms and buildings, and it was well lit. And mm-hmm. they had this hospital underground to where we were treated, and that's where they had amputated my foot. It was the 35th Field Evac Hospital.
And where was it located? Do you remember?
The town? I don't know. Hmm. But it was just somewhere in Germany there yet. Across the border in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you, that actually happened. Now, where was your mind at? I mean, did you say to yourself, well, look, my life's over, or did you have to learn to just adapt to it, you know?
No, my first thoughts were that I really didn't know that my leg was really as bad as it was. And the sensation was a phantom feeling that it was still there.
Mm-hmm.
However, whenever I got to the hospital and did finally know that my foot was cut off, it did make me feel real bad. I said that my life was over. As a soldier, I was through.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you have
it? I did feel bad because I did not get to my objective, which I had thought. I said at one time I thought that we were going to go through Europe, and a route that we were taking would take me through Czechoslovakia, which was my parents' grandparents' country. And eventually the division did go right through and stayed in Czechoslovakia, but I never made it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had that feeling that my life was over.
Did you have it?
I didn't. At that time, the feeling was I didn't care if I lived or died.
Mm-hmm.
To being crippled, which at that time I didn't know, but...
Right.
You felt that you just lost not your manhood but your
growing up. You have all four limbs, you know, and then all, you know.
Right, that there was something that had happened to you that you just like if you get shot with a bullet, it's going to heal and your wounds will heal and you'll be all right again. But whenever you lose a limb, you're losing something that can never be replaced.
Yeah. I want to ask you about it. Did they give you the Purple Heart for...
Well, yeah. Anybody that gets wounded in action or due to enemy action gets wounded in a combat area is awarded the Purple Heart.
Now, when you
of course, there's
that,
a lot of cheap and funny stories about tin cans and getting cut with cutting yourself and getting the Purple Heart, but... Mm-hmm. It is due to enemy action that you receive the Purple Heart.
When oddly, I have this question: like, when you receive that, did you say, "Well, I lost a limb"? I mean, what's this award going to do to me? I mean, you know.
No, I actually didn't get the award. Although you knew that when you were hurt, you get the Purple Heart. So everybody was counting their points on how many points you needed to get out of the Army at that time. You had to have so many points to get out of the Army.
Point system.
Everybody was counting, well, you got 5 more points or 10 more points, and if you got the Purple Heart, you got so many more points. So the Purple Heart at that time didn't enter my mind. Mm-hmm. I actually, like you say, wasn't awarded the medal itself until I was in the hospital here in Atlantic City.
You know, right after in that camp hospital, did you have the feeling of, you know, just blaming somebody, that you, maybe that lieutenant or perhaps the, you know, there was some...
Well, originally, yes. I still do think that it was the lieutenant's fault. The lieutenant knew that the field was mine, and the wire was tripped by the lieutenant, which made me, the lieutenant was a glory man.
Okay.
He had been to fortune tellers, and they had told him that he was going to meet his wife in Tokyo. So he felt that whatever we did in Europe, nothing was going to happen to him. And that sort of did get me mad, because any time there was any volunteers asked for by the company commander, Lieutenant Culbertson wanted the volunteer, because I would say he was looking for the glory.
Right.
And he thought that nothing was going to happen to him because he was going to end up in Japan. So Culbertson would volunteer, and who did he pick? Pastrick and Ostendorf, the two of us, to go lead his night.
To make him look good.
Yeah, if we'd go out on night reconnaissance, why, he'd volunteer for all of them.
You just weren't too happy.
And I just wasn't too happy because he had picked me and this young kid, Ray Ostendorf. He was a young kid from Minnesota somewhere. I felt sorry for him because eventually, in one of the letters I received, I found out that kid was killed.
There was a lot of young people, I suppose, that...
They were mostly, I would say, that at that time, the kids in my squad were all 18, 19 years old, maybe the oldest 20. I was 24, which I considered myself old at that time.
That's true, they were recruiting a lot of
young people. Yeah, they were just picking them all at that time, 18, 19 years old. As soon as they turned 18, they'd be drafted. There were a lot of young kids.
Okay. And after leaving the camp hospital, you went back home to the United States?
No, after leaving the field at that hospital, I traveled quite a distance to get back home. They took us from the field evac hospital, and we went by ambulance, and we went by train, and by ship to England. Mm-hmm. And in England, we had stayed there at a hospital, and then by ambulance, they took us to Wales. I'd stayed at a hospital in Abergavenny. I'll never forget that town in Wales. Mm-hmm. And we stayed there until they decided to fly us back home. Then we made the trip back by ambulance and then by plane from England. They flew us back to Paris.
Now you're talking, referring to a whole group of...
No, a whole group of wounded. They were taking all the wounded that would not... recuperate enough to go back in a battle. All the guys that were decided that they would be out of commission for the war were sent to hospitals back to the States. At Orly Field in Paris, we were among the first air evacuees to be flown back to the States. Originally, they were all sent home aboard hospital ships.
Mm-hmm.
And we were one of the first flights to fly from York back to the States.
I was curious to know, what kind of medical treatment did you receive? You know, did they give you any kind of therapy or any kind of...
Not in Europe. Mm-hmm. At Europe, all they did was treated the wound and kept placing bandages and replacing bandages. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was back in the States, after we landed in the States, they took us to Atlantic City General Hospital, where I had had the second operation on my leg, where they cut the leg to fit the limb, the artificial limb. And there, we had received the therapy.
I see. Now, after coming home and, you know, feeling the way you did, what were your intentions? Was there anything you wanted to, you know, did you set your goals straight, or?
No, at that time, I said, being in Atlantic City, New Jersey, life was too good down there to have anything in mind. As a matter of fact, I was offered a couple jobs in Atlantic City, which I'm sorry today I didn't take, knowing what has happened to Atlantic City now.
Oh, I see.
But I liked Atlantic City. I liked it very much. I met quite a few people there, nice people. And Joe DiMaggio, among one, was a patient at the hospital when I was there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was he?
He was in for his foot. He had spurs on his heels. And, Joe D was one of the patients at the hospital while I was there.
What, after arriving home, can you tell us the type of benefits that you received? You know, as soon as you got arrived home, was there benefits where you could go ahead and go to school, or they'll line you up with a job or anything like that?
Well, at that time, they had what they called the 5220 Club. Veterans that were discharged from the service, couldn't find work, could collect unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
That was $20 a week for 52 weeks, is where the name 5220 comes in. So you were on unemployment, which you could collect. And again, jobs weren't the easiest, even right after the war.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I'd gone up the station at that time was WKST in Newcastle, and they used to have a veterans program. And you'd go up and you would give a brief biography of yourself, just like you're asking here.
Mm-hmm.
Your ethnic background, your experiences before the war, and what you were qualified for work, and they tried to help place you to get jobs. And I happened to be called for one of those interviews, and did have a radio broadcast at that time. No television, it was radio. And they did try to get jobs for you. Like I say, that jobs even then, with all these defense plants shutting down after the war, there weren't too many jobs even right after the war.
What type of employment did you receive right after, the first job you did take right after? Well, I did want to know, when did you get discharged? No, officially.
Oh, officially, I got discharged in April 1946. I was discharged in Atlantic City, right from the hospital.
So then, there was like a lapse, then you didn't go to work or nothing, then you, yeah.
No, at that time, like I say, there wasn't much work, and since you were collecting that $20 a week,
mm-hmm.
it gave you at least spending money. You didn't have to worry too much about,
right.
Other necessities, being single and
mm-hmm.
not having family obligations. I says that you just didn't have to worry too much about it.
Okay. After you arrived home, how did they treat you, your family, and, you know, were they happy that you, at least you made it, or did they
No, again, to my mother, it was a hard pill, because she felt the same way. I know that one day when I come home from the hospital on furlough, my neighbor across the street happened to be the medical officer at Atlantic City Hospital, Joe Colby, Colonel Joe Colby, or he was a major at that time, he made colonel eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Major Colby was coming home, and he brought me home, and when he come up to the house, he laid on a horn, and he just blew the horn, and all the neighbors come outside running to see what's going on, and I was on crutches, and my mother cried. Because he said that he blew the horn, and it was like people gathering around to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Not a freak of nature, but because mm-hmm. I had lost my leg, everybody come out to see, and not to see. If they would have come over to greet you, you wouldn't have felt half as bad, but everybody was just peeking out of their windows and
mm-hmm.
looking, and come out in the porch and look and go back in. I think it hurt her more. I knew. It was a fact I had accepted, and by that time I had realized that what I'm going to get out of life is what I'm going to make out of it. Mm-hmm. Injury or not, you do know that you have a handicap, but that doesn't stop you from doing the things you want to do. And earlier, I did. I'd ice skate, I could do roller skate. Mm-hmm. I says, I bowled, I golfed. I says, I didn't let anything stop me mm-hmm. from doing what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was going to ask you, you know, being a veteran during World War II, that when you, let's say, walked into a bar, would people buy you drinks and, you know, make you feel, you know, oh, we were glad you were over there fighting for us and stuff? Because some of the people I do talk to, especially during the World War II.
Well, not after the war. During the war, if you came home, which I did on one furlough, I won't forget, I come home and they threw a party for me, the people that I worked with at this machine shop, Frank C. Dodds. And as a matter of fact, I stayed in town, extended my furlough to have a war bond drive. But people during the war were really friendly. Yes, I would say that they did feel that you were doing something for the country and for them. Mm-hmm. But after the war had ended, there were so many veterans at home. Just a couple nights ago, I was laying in bed thinking of how many guys on our street went. And in one block, I think I had counted like 25 fellows that I knew went to the service just in one block.
You know,
so you see, whenever they come home, mm-hmm. and almost every month there were a couple more coming home, but it got to be like, so what? So you're home. You know, the war's mm-hmm. over and you're home.
I see. I understand that. So, right after you did home, you were home for a while, I suppose. And did you get employed?
No, like I say, jobs weren't at the best. And at that time, my brother, who had been discharged from the Navy, he was married, living in Lowellville. And we were more or less looking at Youngstown for jobs. And it happened that my brother and his wife had found a home in Struthers that was for sale, and the family looked at it and decided that we'd buy it. So we moved mm-hmm. to the Youngstown district of Struthers to be near some place to work. Now, I did work at the William B. Pollock Company, but that was prior to the war. Okay. After the war, my first job was here in Youngstown, was running a auto driver training school. Yeah, a man from Pittsburgh, Mock, he had started these driver training schools.
Now, weren't these cars standard shift?
Most of the cars at that time were still standard shifts.
And you were able to drive?
We didn't have the gadgets in them that they have now.
Mm-hmm.
I took over the school, and I says, I had the driver school there for about 2 years, and I'd hire guys with their cars, like mm-hmm. yours, and paid them, I forget what, about seven,
oh, I see.
$7 an hour or something like that. I don't think it was that high, about $5 an hour. And they would take out people in their car. We could, on Mill Creek Park, I had the office then downtown at the Purple Heart Club. I had a phone there, an office,
mm-hmm.
teach people right from downtown to learn how to drive.
Did you get employment down at the mill?
Yeah, then in 47 eventually I put in an application with Sheet and Tube. My brother-in-law was working at Sheet and Tube, and I guess my younger brother had already got a job there.
Oh, so they all made it back for life?
Yeah, so I just want to say that we moved to Struthers to be near work, and I had put in an application at the Sheet and Tube, and I got called to the Briar Hill Works for a clerking job in electric weld shipping, and was hired. I said that didn't take too long.
And then did you remain with that company for a while?
And I stayed with Youngstown Sheet and Tube for approximately 30 years. 2 weeks short of 30 years. until 1977 when they put me on pension.
Now, you know, working, now, did your handicap affect the way you work, or did you just learn to simply overcome it?
No, at work it was simple. I didn't do too much walking. I walked about a quarter of a mile from the office down to the mill, two or three times a day, all depending, because I was a tally check clerk, and we used to go down, pick up the tallies, or somebody would bring them up to us. If they brought them up to us, then we didn't have to go down. But we went at the beginning of the turn, at the end of the turn, for sure. At least two trips to make sure that we had all the tallies from the previous turn, and you made sure you had all from your turn, so that you could get them in for the day's business.
Mm-hmm.
But the walking, there wasn't much walking to the job.
And you did receive some sort of governmental benefit after for the injury, or?
No. Yes. For the injury, I went to Cleveland Veterans Hospital, and they gave you a complete physical exam where they evaluated you, and they placed a rate of disability, and your pension, which is called disability compensation. It isn't a pension; it's a disability compensation for your injuries.
Why I asked that was because, you know, a lot of the veterans, like from Vietnam and stuff like that, you know, comparing the benefits, the type of benefits you might have received as you were a veteran in World War II compared to the veterans of, you know, Vietnam, there's such a contrast, you know.
It's a shame, because I would advise any veteran that's come back and has his discharge to take advantage of the veteran's benefits that he can get. I'm sorry today that I didn't take up the GI Bill of Rights educational.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, at the time I come back, so I'm 26 years old, I felt I was too old.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of guys did go to college and took it because they had the opportunity. Some of them didn't use it. Most of them did.
Mm-hmm.
And you had your loans, your government loans for education, you had government loans for housing, that there were advantages, I would say, in World War II, on the benefits, but like you say, that these Vietnam veterans aren't getting.
Basically, maybe it was because you guys had a cause. And maybe.
Well, whatever they called it.
Do you have anything else that you think is important to add that we didn't cover at all? Maybe.
No, I would think that there's some things that we might have skipped that would be relevant to what you objectively are seeking. But like I just said, that if any veterans have any chance to take advantage of the benefits, that they should use them.
Oh, one question I'll ask, how do you feel about the draft now? I mean, would you want your children to go? I mean, do you feel it's right? I mean, how's your feelings now? Have they changed?
Deep down inside, I feel that if they are called, and if there is direct confrontation between the United States and some foreign power, I wouldn't feel bad if they went. However, if it would be just to show might or to fall into some other fiasco like we did in Vietnam, I really wouldn't want to see them go. I am not encouraging them to go, but I would not stop them if they wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you that. If they want to go, I will not stop them or try to talk them out of it. I think it's an honor, privilege for them to serve the country, but at the same time, if it's going to be
a
deal like these kids got with the Vietnam, I wouldn't like to see them go.
I might be back, if possible, sometime there with some follow-up questions, if you wouldn't mind, because there might be some things I might want to really check out, you know.
Yeah, if there's things, like I say, that doing this now, that we're doing it with out of memory, that's, what the heck is it, 30-some years ago, now it says I can't think of everything that I could have answered maybe better, but the things that I...
Well, I appreciate the time. I mean, you know...
Could give you, or things that just come off the top of the mind here, so that if there's anything else that you would need that could help, I'd be glad.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Pastor.